Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's had a voice treatment and plans to be back tomorrow. A.S. Byatt is known as one of Britain's finest writers, an intellectual who can tell a page-turner of a story. Her novel Possession won the Booker Prize 9 years ago, and she is a current finalist for the prestigious British Award for her new novel. The winner's going to be announced tomorrow. Her book is called The Children's Book. It is a multi-family saga set in England just before World War I. A.S. Byatt joins us from the BBC in London. A.S. Byatt, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. Our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Now, this is quite the complicated story you've written. The book is 675 pages long, about several families and their friends from 1895 to the end of World War I. And you say it all started with the psychological seedbed of what happens to the real children of famous children's book authors. Tell us about that.
Well, I found that I was noticing that the children of children's book writers tended to end up rather badly, and indeed several committed suicide. The most interesting one, in a way, is the son of Kenneth Graham, who wrote The Wonderful Wind in the Willows, in which we all lived, my generation, when we were children. And he had this son called Mouse, for whom the book was ostensibly written, who never managed to fit into the world at all, and it showed signs of violence, and was got into Oxford by his father, and then went out from dinner one night and simply lay down on a railway line in front of a train and was killed. And his father persisted in believing it had been an accident. And then there was the boys who were adopted by J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan for them because he loved them, and when their parents died, he adopted them. But the second one of those whom he loved most died, was drowned with another undergraduate in what appeared to be a suicide pact. And there was a very famous writer called Alison Utley, whose works I loved again when I was very little. And her son, as a grown man, got in a car and drove himself over Beachy Head and crashed into the sea, which is a favourite way of committing suicide in Britain. And I began to think this is more than a coincidence.
So why?
And then I began to go. Sorry, no, go on.
I was going to say, so why do you think that the authors of these children's books that are so beloved and written in many cases with their own children in mind, why do you think their offspring end up in these desperate circumstances?
Well, I began to wonder if the children's book writers wanted to go on inhabiting a childhood world. And in fact, they wrote for themselves as children to perpetuate their own childhood. And the children, the real children, felt somehow closed out or not included. That was one theory I had. Another was that they created a kind of world, an unreal world, in which both parent and child lived, and this stopped the child from being able to live in the real world. So I started exploring it and inventing characters to fit both theories, really.
So in your new book, The Children's Book, at the center of your story is the author of children's books, whose name is Olive Wellwood. Who is she?
She is Olive Wellwood. People keep saying she's the children's writer E. Nesbit, and she has in common with E. Nesbit that she has a very large family of children of her own, some of whom are not really hers and some of whom are not really her husband's, and there are all sorts of mysteries, as there were in many of the great Edwardian families at the time. She also has a lot in common with D.H. Lawrence. She's a working-class woman from the northern mining areas from which I myself come. And she has risen in the world by being intelligent and falling in love with a man who marries her despite her being very poor. That has nothing to do with E. Nesbit, who was a fairly rich middle-class woman. I've pieced her together out of a lot of people. I find you can make a real character if you've got a lot of originals. Then you get somebody who isn't based on anybody, and the character has a freer life, I think.
Now, Olive suffered terrible losses in her family as a child and as a young woman, and I wonder, does she write fairy tales as a way to deal with those tragedies in her personal life.
Well, she told herself fairy tales as a girl, and she was sent into service at one point, and she became a sort of skivvy, a maid in somebody's house. And she survived by telling herself stories, and I think all those of us who write have done that. I certainly survived boarding school by writing long stories in notebooks very secretly behind the boiler in the basement of the school where I was a boarder. And she went on doing it because she enjoyed it. And so she took her imaginary life with her and cut herself off from her real life.
And she wrote a separate children's book for each of her children. She had seven children. Why did she do that?
I think she did it because she wanted to give them a story of their own. She wrote each of them a different story in a different book with a different coloured cover, and they were meant to be sort of half-secret stories. But, of course, if you look at it, this is quite a dangerous thing to do because she's giving them a story she's written, whereas she made up her own stories when she was a child. And so, in a sense, they've become rather passive. Their story is being written for them by their mother. And this is both good and bad. I mean, it's not very simple, really, but it has both good effects and bad effects.
Now, this novel is set in England in the late Victorian and Edwardian eras. Why did you want to set it in that period? What about that era interest you?
Well, that is the period of great children's writing. I've mentioned Peter Pan and E. Nesbitt. There's also there's also Rudyard Kipling, whose children's stories I passionately love. And it's the period when all the great fairy stories were rediscovered and put in the Violet Fairy Book, the Blue Fairy Book, the Red Fairy Book by Andrew Lang. So it seemed a good period. And the other thing that interested me was that E. Nesbitt was a sort of founding member of the Fabian Society and, you know, a principled socialist at the same time as writing fantasy stories for children. So I got interested in the connections between socialism and fairy stories.
Now this period,
and also I wanted...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say I wanted to put in Germans because I love German fairy stories best, I think. They're the most frightening, the most dangerous.
Now, looking back, this period also in some ways seems like an innocent era, the period before World War I, and an era that really got transformed once the war began. Was that also part of it?
Yes, it was. It was a kind of golden age. It was an age when children wandered in the countryside without being afraid of anything much. You know, they might break their leg playing cricket, but they weren't afraid of human dangers. They were allowed to roam, and yet the adults talked to them as though they were people. And everybody went on very long walks and enjoyed the earth in a way that is much more difficult now. And I don't think those people had any idea that that war was coming. I think my parents knew that the Second World War was coming long before it came. But from all the reading I did, the First World War burst in upon this innocent world where everybody was hopeful that things would get better and devastated everybody.
And it really forced everyone to grow up.
Well, if they didn't die, a lot of them died. Those who didn't die had to grow up and, you know, and endured a tragedy. The number of people who were killed is appalling.
Our phone lines are open.
The number of young men.
Our phone lines are open. We'll be taking your calls in a few minutes. 1-800-433-8850. Now, you mentioned the Fabian Society. Not all Americans may know what that is. Tell us about it.
Well, it was a society formed by several principled people, and it was called after a Roman general called Fabius Cunctator, who was famous because he delayed things. Cunctator means I delay things. And they wanted to reform society slowly. They were not revolutionaries. They wanted to make really good plans to make society better. They were the people behind the invention of the old age pension, and they got rid of the workhouses and invented benefits for people who were out of work, because most of the poor simply died if they had an accident at work or anything. They did an enormous amount of work with sort of local councils, making them better organised and making things better. They were good people. My own father was a Fabian later on in the 30s and 40s and 50s. They were a kind of thinking end of the left in Britain. They weren't, in fact, the Labour Party. Some of them were and some of them weren't. They were hopeful people. They meant to make things a lot better. And some of them were very overconfident and arrogant. H.G. Wells was a Fabian at one point and really upset them by standing and making speeches and trying to move everybody on the committee, which included George Bernard Shaw, out of his way so he could run it all. But they overcame him. They still exist and do a lot of good thinking, I think.
Now, Olive's husband, Humphrey, is a Fabian in your book. And I wonder, just briefly, what role does Fabianism play in the children's book?
It's part of the hopefulness, I think. It's part of the tragedy that the First World War hit that society. And as I say, they were good people. And, of course, the children's book writers were good people. And everybody meant to make things better. And I think I have a sort of... I am in no way a Christian, but I have a view of original sin and disaster and tragedy. I think they wanted to do more good than it's possible to do.
Yeah, we're going to have to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with A.S. Byatt about her new novel. It's called The Children's Book. And we'll take some of your calls and questions, or you can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And we're joined from London by A.S. Byatt. She's the author of several novels, including Possession, which won a Booker Prize 9 years ago. Novellas, she's a critic. Her new novel is called The Children's Book, and it's the story of several families in England at a time during the late Edwardian era. And A.S. Byatt, I was wondering if you could read us just perhaps the very beginning of your book to give our listeners a taste of it.
Yes, here we go. A lot of the novel has to do with the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and this is where the book begins. Two boys stood in the Prince Consort Gallery and looked down on a third. It was June the 19th, 1895. The prince had died in 1861 and had seen only the beginnings of his ambitious project for a gathering of museums in which British craftsmen could study the best examples of design. His portrait, modest and medalled, was done in mosaic in the tympanum of a decorative arch at one end of the narrow gallery, which ran above the space of the South Court. The South Court was decorated with further mosaics, portraits of painters, sculptors, potters. It was called the Kensington Valhalla.
All right, thank you for reading that. And we're going to go to the phones now. We've got some listeners who have been waiting patiently. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. We're joined first by Mark, who calls us from Aurora, Illinois. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. This is fascinating, as it's a merger of two of my favorite interests, literature and psychology. And I, maybe my third theory about why these children come to a bad end is sort of implicit in the first two, but I should think that any adult who creates child characters tends to bond deeply with them. I think that it's inevitable that an artist bonds with his own creations, and perhaps often these are idealized creations, and depending on how big the discrepancies are between the fictive characters and the real children of the author, the real children of the author could have serious self-esteem problems, as in, well, they don't verbalize it to themselves, but they must be saying to themselves, I don't live up to this, or I'm not like this, and maybe mommy or daddy loves these created characters more than they love me.
Interesting, Mark. Go ahead.
I think this is very right. I think this does very much happen. I think the other thing that happens is that the children are drawn into the story and want to be the fictive characters in order to please the parents. And this is also not very good for the children. There's a confusion going on. And I don't know, I mean, as a child, I found my imaginary world very much more real than the real world. But if the parent is invading the child's imaginary world and taking it over, this is quite dangerous.
It could be narcissistic, Harvard, too.
I think it has to be narcissistic, which is unfortunate, but I think it just has to be.
Well, now, you yourself are a successful writer, although of adult books, not children's books. And I wonder, do you think that your writing has affected your own children?
I don't know. My children vary. One of them doesn't read my books at all. One of them reads some of them rather casually, and one of them reads them rather intently but never tells me what she thinks. That's A. B, anybody who writes very long books neglects their children to a certain extent. There is no way of getting round this. I think you can love them very much. And I think the thing I do have, having thought long and deeply about this problem, I know that my children are separate beings. I always have known that. I've known that they have their own life and their own secrets, and I don't want to invade them. I just want to know my children as people. And they're all three grown-up women now, and I think I do know them as people. I think we get on. And they have survived my preoccupations in my younger days. And now, of course, it doesn't matter to them if I sit upstairs in the attic furiously scribbling all the time, because they're busy with their own lives.
Now, do you actually write in an attic?
I write in an attic, looking out on, you wouldn't believe, all sorts of really strange birds, including parrots. We have parrots in my South London garden. And I can see the tops of the trees, and I write by hand. I don't write on the computer.
And do you write in longhand on legal pads or on paper? How do you write?
I write on A4 paper with narrow feint, and I get very distressed if I haven't got exactly the sort I write on. And I write with a fairly fine black liner kind of pen, and I have about 200 of those at any time in the house in case one of them doesn't work or I've lost it. And in this way I go along quite sanely, really. And I have a sort of wonderful person in Wales who types it all up. And she now types with voice recognition, so the errors on the proofs are quite different from the kind of errors they used to be when I typed it myself.
And, you know, one thing about this book is the intertwined stories of several families and the great number of characters who matter, characters you really need to keep track of. And I wonder, when you started writing the beginning of this book, did you have family trees in mind, and did you have a good sense of all these characters, or did they unfold as you went through the writing process?
It took me a long time to get round to writing it, partly because I was ill, and then I broke my wrist when I just started writing it and had to stop, which means that they grew in my mind for a very long time before I set pen to paper. And I had all sorts of very complicated Excel maps of the chronology of the time from 1895 to 1919 and how old any character was during any year. Because one of the real traps of it is that you make one of the characters is growing up nicely and you describe his or her growing up. And you forget that the others are also growing up. You think that so-and-so is 16. You forget that means that so-and-so is no longer 12 but 14. And so I had this very careful map where they all were.
You know, the Excel map of your character seems quite at odds with writing with a fine pen on good paper in longhand.
Well, I don't write with a fine pen out of any sort of aesthetic affectation. I write because I'm 73 and I think with my fingers. I can't actually think hard with a computer, but I can work an Excel map and, you know, and I can correct things on a computer and I write all my journalism on a computer. But for some reason, it's the actual physical rhythm of the hand moving over the paper that I need in order to invent a story.
That's so interesting. Now, did any of your characters turn out to surprise you? Did they just insist on doing something you didn't expect them to do?
Yes, I think the most surprising one is Prosper Kane, who is a keeper of precious metals, an imaginary keeper of precious metals in the Victoria and Albert Museum. And I intended him to be a sort of robust, sort of flamboyant Victorian character. And in the early drafts of the notes for the novel, he was called the Old Pirate. He was meant to be piratical and sort of secretly acquiring other people's jewellery for his museum. And in fact, he turns out to be, I think, one of my favourite characters. And he turns out to be a good man at a rather deep level. He's a widower. He had an Italian wife and he has two children, a boy and a girl, who grow up through the time of the novel. And I think I thought he was a rather minor character, but he moves more and more into the centre as the novel goes on. And I got to feel rather pleased that I knew him, really. I like him. And I had meant to sort of make him slightly comic, instead of which he became interesting. So I like him. And then there is a working-class boy who wants to be a potter, who is one of the very central characters. And I knew he had a sister who walks down from the pottery area in the middle of England to the south where all these people are. And I knew she would become part of some group of people studying the arts. But I didn't know what she was like, this sort of second-generation working-class girl, when I started writing it. And again, she's rather sort of fierce and ferocious, and she won't be put down, and she won't keep to her place. And she thinks very hard, and I got very fond of her too.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones and take a question or a comment from a listener. We'll go to Sonia, who's calling us from Port Huron, Michigan. Sonia, thanks for holding on. Sonia? Well, Sonia, I'm sorry, seems to be gone. Let's go instead to Edward. He's calling us from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Edward.
Hello. Finally got on. It took a long time.
Well, thank you for holding on. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes. I want to comment on what she said, those two comments earlier on about how children are affected by being used as characters in their parents' stories. The son of the author of the Winnie the Pooh series said I guess he was celebritized as a boy. He was even like young girls who liked him. I mean, he became somewhat actually like a celebrity, like famous, because of his status as being the character as Christopher Robin in the Pooh series. However, later in life, the boys that were jealous, like when the girls were liking him back when he was a boy, like they took revenge and they badgered him unremittingly with respect to his previous status as Christopher Robin. And actually, I know the author donated the rights to Winnie the Pooh to the Royal Literary Society. So I guess his son would not get any of that money. But you would think that after what he had suffered, you know, the father could have at least given him the rights so that he could make some money off of it. But maybe he wasn't even interested. He may have been so hurt by. But they say that, you British, you're a little bit overkill in the clown in the clown category. You know, you tend to go into clown overkill. I mean, not everybody, but some of you. And you just, I don't know, you just, it like seemed to me like it was a challenge for these young men to, like, torture him to see, like, that they could drive him crazy.
I'm not sure what clown overkill means, but A.S. Byatt, let me give you a chance to comment.
No, I'm not sure what it means either, but he did write a very good autobiography in which he did describe, and I found that very moving, how he had made sort of serious efforts to remove himself from this myth of this infantile boy. Christopher Robin in his little knickers and little shoes, dragging a teddy bear by one hand. And I think it made it very, very difficult for him. And I read a biography of the father, too, and I think the father just didn't realise that it was going to explode so much, that poor Christopher Robin was going to be so overexposed to the press writing about him and loving him as a little boy. And, of course, little boys grow up very fast. He can't have been little Christopher Robin for very, very long. But he is a most dignified man, I think, Christopher Milne, for whom one has great respect. He didn't kill himself. He didn't do anything silly, and he did distance himself. And he's a very admirable aspect of this problem.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850, and we'll read your emails at drshow@wamu.org. Well, let's go to Timothy. He's calling us from Birmingham, Alabama. Timothy, thanks for holding.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to speak with you, Ms. Byatt. I so admire your work, and the topic is most interesting. As a writer, I am struggling with a novel I'm working on, and I don't think it will cause any suicides. It may cause my murder, but in any case, I wonder how you go about, as you write, when you have a person in your life who is so fascinating and interesting, especially when that person perhaps has a rather prominent position in society, politics, and so forth, is highly admired. And in my case, I've been very intimate with some of these people, and some of them are family members. Some of the truth is far too interesting and fascinating, and some of my insights and my perspectives being intimate with them are just too interesting. I cannot possibly fictionalize them in a way that would do anything but destroy the story. And I want to know how do you go about that, and how do you draw the line where you tell something rather intimate about someone at the risk of possibly revealing things to the public and to their intimates, their children, their family members, that is really very deeply private in some ways?
Well, this is a very interesting question because of what you rightly observe, which is that if you try to write something down that's different and the truth is as interesting as it is, it always pulls the truth pulls the story back towards itself with a dreadful magnetism. The way I've got round it is to only write characters who are made up from three or four or five people. They're not based on anybody. And I'm getting better and better at that, you know, whether I write about historical people or modern people. If one finds analogies in several people, paradoxically, you can then invent a person who isn't any of them. I think one should not reveal intimate details of other people's lives. I feel quite strongly about that. You feel you have a right because your book is so good, and in some sense you probably do have a right because your book is so good. But I always sympathise with the person whose life is being written about, if you see what I mean. And I think it's possible, you know, you say you were writing about sort of famous and powerful people. It is possible to add five or six of them together and invent a famous and powerful person who isn't any of them, don't you think?
Timothy, what do you think?
Yes, I do, but I wonder if you have any sense of or any sort of formula or way of going about that. Could you elaborate just a bit on how you draw those characters one from another and another? Is there anything you can tell me?
I read and read, and then I see what they have in common. You know, people overlap. Two people have the same thing in common, even though they don't have other things in common. And if you find enough places where they have things in common, it curiously sets you free from them. It's very difficult to describe rapidly. I think if one releases oneself from any biographical thing. I know a writer who wrote a book about a woman who had a child who wet the bed very late, and her child never forgave her, although this child was not in any way, she said, the character in the book. I think one has to be very careful with details that reveal the person. That's the negative way of going about it. Don't reveal details that belong to somebody.
All right. Well, Timothy, thank you very much for that interesting question. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue talking with A.S. Byatt about her new book. It's called The Children's Book. It's a novel set in England. And we'll go back to the phones and take some of your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
I've got your picture that you gave to me.
Roseanne Cash was 18 when her father, Johnny Cash, wrote a list of songs he thought she should know. On the next Fresh Air, we hear some of those and talk with Roseanne Cash. Her new album is called The List. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking with A.S. Byatt. She joins us by phone from the BBC in London. She's talking about her new novel. It's called The Children's Book. You know, we have a couple emailers who have written in about a previous book you wrote called Possession. Here's one from Lisa in Syracuse, New York. She says, "Your characters, especially in Possession and the Frederica books, remain with me much in the same way that Dickens' characters do. Scenes from Babel Tower continue to haunt me years after reading and rereading the book." And here's another one from Tony, who writes us from Traverse City, Michigan. He says, "In 1991, I was working at a windsurfing shop in Annapolis, Maryland. A customer left a copy of Possession on the counter. I flipped through it. I was astounded by the incredible use of language. I read that book three times and credit Miss Byatt for my return to college. Thank you."
Huh. How wonderful. How very wonderful. And I'm always pleased when people mention Babel Tower, because it's a book I'm very fond of.
Now, your book, Possession, won the Booker Prize. We're going to have the announcement tomorrow of the new Booker Prize winner, and your novel, The Children's Book, is on the short list of finalists. How do you feel about that? Do you hope you win?
Of course I hope I win. It's partly this time very much for the sake of the book, because I like this book. when Possession was there, I expected not to win because there were books I thought were just as good in contention. And this year, the shortlist is extremely strong and every book on it is very good. But I'm very attached to the children's book because it was complicated to write and I think it reads easily. And I want it to win for its sake. It's not me, it's it.
Now, you say, I like this book. Are there some books that you've written that you think, I don't really like this book?
I'm not going to tell you which. I don't always like them. I've done my best with them and unhappy things have gone into them. And I mostly don't reread anything I've written after I've written. But I have been rereading little bits of this one and rather enjoying it. And this is a new experience. So anyway, I hope it wins. But as I say, all the other five books which I have read are extremely good. So it's all in the lap of the judges.
Now, we should note that if you win, you will be the first woman to have won the Booker Prize twice. So that would be quite an achievement.
Well, that's what I think. I think it's important because there's a sort of history in Britain of criticising the Booker Prize for not shortlisting enough women and not enough women winning. And indeed, the whole prize was founded for novels by women in order to get over this problem, which I don't think is quite true, really. I think there have been a lot of very good books by women always in the Booker shortlists, and a lot of women have won. But it would be nice. It would be exciting to be the first woman to win. Only two people have ever won it twice at all, Peter Carey and J.M. Coetzee. So, I mean, another way of looking at it, I would be, if I did win, only the third person to win it twice.
Well, we'll be watching for that announcement tomorrow. Now, the role of women plays some part in your new novel. Olive is a modern woman and a free thinker. Women were beginning to have more rights in the Edwardian era you're writing about.